From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, we're rebroadcasting some favorite conversations. Author Salman Rushdie discusses his latest novel, The Golden House, and actress Sonequa Martin-Green on her groundbreaking role in Star Trek Discovery. But first, Bernie Sanders, independent senator from Vermont, joins us to discuss his plan to provide health care for every American. He also shares his thoughts on what it will take to transform American politics as outlined in his new book called Bernie Sanders' Guide to Political Revolution. Senator Sanders, good to have you on the program.
Great to be with you, Tavis.
Let me start by asking whether or not you are more annoyed about having to continue to answer questions about what Hillary Clinton said, or are you more annoyed about what she said?
Well, a little bit of both. But the bottom line is, you know, that primary election ended well over a year ago. And right now, we're confronting enormous problems with the Trump administration, you know, whether it is the disastrous health care ideas, whether it is throwing 800,000 young people off of DACA, whether it is their refusal to acknowledge the reality of climate change, whether it's the desire to give huge tax breaks to billionaires. We got enough to worry about today. And in 2018 and 2020, I don't think we have to revisit and rehash the primary campaign.
One or two follow-ups, and I promise I won't ask anything else about Hillary. What, since you said you're a little annoyed by both, that you continue to get asked about it and annoyed that she said it, can you tell me what most annoys you about what she said? What gets under your skin the most?
Well, you know, the thought that we did not strongly support her in the election. I did everything that I can. And by the way, you know, some of my supporters were not all that happy about it. But I said over and over again, we have got to do everything that we can to elect Hillary Clinton. We don't want to wake up the day after the election and have the disaster of Donald Trump being president. And I was all over the country working as hard as I could. And to suggest that was not the case, you know, that's kind of disappointing.
Given the way that Donald Trump has behaved or misbehaved as president, do you believe now, in retrospect, that had you gotten the nomination, you really could have beaten him?
Again, that's speculation, Tavis. Who knows? I think what I can say, and what is a fact, is that most of the polls had me ahead of him and doing better against him than Hillary Clinton was doing. Does that mean definitively that I would have won? No. Does that mean it was likely that I could have won? The answer is yes.
So the next question is, how are you faring in the era of Donald Trump? Everybody has their postmortem on the election and what it means to be on Capitol Hill in the era of Trump. What do you make of it?
Well, you know, the answer is we're doing the best that we can to try to fend off the disastrous policies that he has brought forth. Right now, it looks like the Republicans are once again coming up with some outrageous health care proposal that will throw tens of millions of Americans off of the health care that they have, defund Planned Parenthood, raise premiums for older workers, and that's resurfacing right now. So we've got to do everything we can to beat that back. We have got to go forward, in my view, not only in protecting the Affordable Care Act now, but moving toward a Medicare for All single-payer program. And I am very proud that when we introduced that bill, we had 16 co-sponsors. And we're getting more and more support all over the country from the American people for the understanding that health care in the United States has got to be a right of all, not just a privilege.
What do you make of late of this newfound friendship between Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi and the president?
Well, you know, the truth is that I don't think Trump has much of an ideology except maybe perhaps being a racist and a xenophobe and so forth. But I think on issues like many other issues, I think he has brought in the Koch brothers people to guide him. But I think he has understood that that extreme right-wing approach may not be working for him politically and that the Republican leadership in the Congress is not terribly popular. So, given that reality, given the fact that he doesn't believe much in anything and what he believes in today may not be the case tomorrow, I think he's figuring out a way to try to maybe, you know, get his poll ratings up a little bit. So if he, in fact, is prepared to reverse course on this DACA situation and figure out a way that we can provide legal status to the 800,000 young people who he was prepared to throw off of legal protection. If he is prepared to move, more importantly, to comprehensive immigration reform, I think that we should work with him. During his campaign, you know, he talked a big deal about the high cost of prescription drugs in this country, which is just a very, very serious problem. Drug companies are ripping off the American people every day. If, in fact, he has some idea of keeping the promises he made to the American people during his campaign, let's work with him on lowering the cost of prescription drugs. He talked about a $1 trillion investment to rebuild the infrastructure. If he is prepared to keep that promise and not want to privatize infrastructure or just give tax breaks to Wall Street in order to rebuild our crumbling roads and bridges, let's work with him on that as well.
I'm not sure that one is better than the other, but when you call Donald Trump a racist and a xenophobe, do you really believe that he is a racist and a xenophobe, or do you think that's some sort of political strategy, as you intimated a moment ago, to placate his base?
The answer is yes and no. I mean, I think if you go back to his attacks on Barack Obama when he was leading the Bertha movement, and trying to delegitimize the administration of the first African-American president. I think that's racist. I can't think of a nicer word to say. When you think about his attacks on the Central Park rape situation, you recall that. Where the young men were found to be innocent and he was persisting on that issue. Well, you call it what you weigh. I don't know. But, it sounds to me like this is kind of racism. Is it political? Is it what he believes? Who knows? But certainly the policies that he has been bringing forth in terms of anti-Muslim, in terms of anti-Latino, in terms of, anti-affirmative action, and so forth and so on, don't look good to me.
Since you mentioned his flip-flopping, which he, of course, continues to do, what do you make of his coming out against DACA one day, and then a couple of days later hanging out with Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi saying we'll find a way to protect the dreamers? I mean, I'm not sure I know where he stands on DACA. Do you know where he stands on DACA?
Well, that's the point. I don't know where he stands on anything. So you do the best that you can within that context of a president who lies a whole lot. And I don't mean to be insulting, but that's just the fact. He lies a lot, changes his mind a lot, and that's a hard situation to deal with. But I think you seize the opportunity. And if for whatever reason, he feels it's in his advantage to reverse course on this horrific, this DACA thing is so ugly. Young people have grown up here in the United States. This is their home. This is where they're working, where they go to school, where they serve in the U.S. military. And to take away their legal status and allow themselves to be open to deportation, that is so ugly, it's almost unimaginable. So if he is willing to reverse course on that, yeah, let's work with him on that.
This might be an impossible question as well. Again, it's made more difficult by the fact that I don't know where he stands on certain things on any given day. But is it possible that if he continues on the course that he's on now, might he be, in fact, on a collision course with his own party? Is it possible that we could see his own party start to turn against him?
Well, I think you're seeing a little bit of that. I mean, when you, from a tactical point of view, when you are the president of the United States and a Republican and you suddenly start making deals with Democratic leadership without even informing the Republican leadership, I think these Republicans are increasingly suspicious and very nervous about their relationship with him.
Back to Medicare, which I promise I want to get back to. So I guess my initial question, Senator Sanders, is what has happened on Capitol Hill? Because I can't see what it is, but you're smarter than I am, and you live there every day. But what's happened on Capitol Hill that makes the territory, the terrain, any more fertile for a real conversation about this now than we had prior to the campaign?
Well, I'll tell you what has happened. Number one, people, I think, have begun to appreciate the gains of the Affordable Care Act. 20 million more Americans now have health insurance. We've done away with this obscenity called a denial of coverage for pre-existing conditions and another number of other positive benefits of the ACA. So that's first thing. People see that. And then they see the Republicans coming up with some of the most horrific legislation that I have seen in the modern history of this country. Can you imagine throwing, depending on the legislation they brought forth, 22, 23, 32 million Americans off of the health insurance they have. Just imagine, Tavis, as somebody who's sitting home on Medicaid with cancer or with diabetes or heart problems, and these guys are talking about doing away with the health insurance. Many of those people will die. We're talking about thousands of people in the United States of America dying if that legislation were to be passed. Fortunately, we were able to beat it back. But anyhow, what people were seeing is, okay, Affordable Care Act did some good. What the Republicans are proposing is horrible, and nobody supports that in America. They had the lowest support of any major legislation in decades. Well, but where do we go from here? Because the Affordable Care Act still contains a whole lot of serious problems. We have too many people, 28 million uninsured. We have even more who are underinsured, high deductibles, high copayments. We are paying the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs. The cost of health care is rising. We are spending, Tavis, $10,000 per person on health care, $10,000. Almost 18% of our GDP, and the projection is that number is going to go up in the next 10 years rather significantly. So the American people are beginning to ask themselves some simple questions. Why are we spending twice as much as Canada or any other major country when our health care outcomes are not necessarily as good as these other countries? Mm-hmm. Why do we pay the highest prices in the world for the medicine that we need? Why are we the only major country not to guarantee health care as a right to all people? And when you start asking those questions, then the solution moves in the direction of saying, okay, we have a Medicare program for people who are 65 or older. It has its problems, and we want to improve it. But generally speaking, it has worked over the last 52 years. Seniors are, by and large, happy with it and proud of it. In fact, that it's the most popular health insurance program in the country. Well, why don't we just expand Medicare to every man, woman, and child in this country? And people are saying, yeah, why not? Why don't we do that? And the advantages of that is that to administer the Medicare program cost 2%, 2% administration. To administer the hundreds of separate plans, private insurance plans that we have, where you have a $5,000 deductible, I have a $10,000 deductible, you pay $25 copayment, I pay $40 copayment. It is enormously complicated, enormously expensive to administer, and it ends up the private insurance companies are spending between 12 and 18% on administration as opposed to 2% for Medicare. The conclusion is if we have one insurance program, a Medicare for all, we can save $500 billion a year on administration. If we negotiate drug prices with the pharmaceutical, like every other country is doing, we probably save another $100 billion. And that's the direction, clearly, we should be going.
So I am certain the conservative right-wing websites are going to have a field day taking clips of what you've said and trying to pick this conversation apart. I would venture to guess that one of the clips they're going to pull is what you just suggested a moment ago, where you sort of intimated, and I can see their headline, Bernie Sanders calls Donald Trump and Republicans doctors of death. What you suggested was that if we go the direction that they want us to go on health care, that many Americans are going to die. How are you going to respond when they say that you say that, Senator Sanders?
I have responded.
Okay.
And the answer is this is not Bernie Sanders. There was a one of the newspapers that checks out the facts that public officials say. They checked it out.
Right.
And they said, yeah, based on a number of studies, I'm not pulling this stuff out of my head here. Based on, look, if you deny, Tavis, this is kind of common sense.
Yeah.
If you take away health insurance from 20 or 30 million people, and you got many of those people dealing with life-threatening illnesses, doesn't take a genius to figure out some of them going to die.
Yeah.
And generally speaking, I think the number was that if you have 23 million people being thrown off of health insurance, I don't know, it was 15, 20, 25,000 people a year will die.
Yeah.
That's all. That's a fact. And they can throw everything they want at me, but there are a number of studies. It's not my information. These are studies done by doctors and scientists.
Right. So it seems to me that when you start this conversation by saying that you had, 16 or 17 co-sponsors when you introduced this legislation, I don't know how anything gets done in the Senate if you can't find some moderate Republicans to come with you. And I just don't know who those moderates are anymore.
Well, Tavis, let me be clear, and I've said this many, many times. Medicare for All, in which we're taking on the drug companies. And by the way, the drug companies have spent in the last 20 years well over $3 billion on lobbying and campaign contributions. They're an incredibly powerful force. The insurance companies are a very powerful force. Wall Street, that makes money from this current healthcare system, obviously very powerful. So no one has ever heard me say that we're going to pass this tomorrow, or we're going to pass this with Republican leadership in the House and the Senate and in the White House. But this is what I am saying. I am saying that more and more Americans understand that that is the direction that we have got to be going in, and polling indicates that, and that the only way we pass this is when millions of people become actively involved in the political process and begin to stand up and fight for a healthcare system that works for the American people, not just for the drug companies and the insurance companies. So essentially, in my view, this is less of a healthcare issue than it is a political issue. I think Medicare for All makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. Hard to argue against it. What we are arguing against is the power of the drug companies and the insurance companies and Wall Street, and they are very powerful people. And our job is to take them on through strong grassroots efforts all over this country. And when we do that, I think we will pass a Medicare for All.
I hear your point. Medicare is one slice of it. I guess the broader question is, how do you even find any room to create Democratic space to have a debate about any domestic program when it appears that the direction they want to move in is to cut domestic spending?
Because what you should appreciate, and what everybody listening should appreciate, is that this Republican agenda is incredibly unpopular. I mean, essentially, the polling for their proposals to throw millions off of health insurance are lower than any other major legislation in recent years. Nobody thinks, or very few people thinks, we should give tax breaks to billionaires and cut programs for working people. Nobody thinks, or very few people think, that we should move Medicare into a voucher type program. Most Americans know that climate change is real and already causing devastating problems, which is not what the Republican leadership or Trump believes. So the point is, their agenda is way out of touch with the American people. The reason they're able to win elections, and they have done very well in that in recent years, is they have unlimited sums of money behind them, and they're able to come up with wedge issues which divide the American people. And what I am doing, and many of us are trying to do, is bring people together, not allow Trump to divide us up by the color of our skin or the country we're born in or our sexual orientation or our religion. Stand together around an agenda that demands the government work for all of us and not just the 1%. And that's kind of the direction we've got to move in.
1% is one number. 12% is another number. And you know where I'm going with this. 12% is the number we are told of the persons who supported you who went on to vote for Donald Trump. Do you believe that number? And if so, what do you make of it?
What I believe, yeah, I don't know. It sounds like it might well be right, and that's kind of low, actually. I believe the number was 24% of people who supported Hillary Clinton in 2008 and then ended up voting for John McCain and against Barack Obama. So, you know, we live in a time when political allegiance to a party is not particularly strong. You know, there are more independents now than Democrats or Republicans. So why would it shock anybody that somebody who voted for Hillary Clinton ended up voting against Obama and for John McCain? Why would it shock anybody that somebody who voted for me would vote against Clinton and vote for Donald Trump?
Let me take a stab at answering that question. I guess what's shocking for some people is that you and Donald Trump are so diametrically opposed on so many issues that it just seems weird that somebody could support you and then flip and support Donald Trump.
Well, I know that, but again, it seems to me to be weird that somebody could support Hillary Clinton and vote for a conservative Republican like John McCain. Look, you know, the world is, we live in a country which is not particularly ideological.
Right.
There are people who like me, people who like Donald Trump, people who like Hillary Clinton, people who like John McCain, people who often vote for the individual. But in fact, again, I would reiterate that, as I understand it, according to some of these studies, twice as many people voted for McCain who had voted for Clinton than was the case in my election.
Not your fault. Yeah, you're not responsible. I'm just asking what you made of it. What does it mean in the era of Donald Trump? What does it mean to Bernie Sanders to be a true progressive?
What it means is to understand, as I mentioned a moment ago, that the Trump agenda of tax breaks to billionaires, of throwing millions of people off of health insurance, of trying to take away legal status for 800,000 young people, of not recognizing the reality and danger of climate change, that all of those things, which is essentially the Republican agenda, is a minority perspective in America. What it means to me as a progressive is to stand with the working family, stand with the middle class, stand with lower income people who are struggling every day to make ends meet, and bring people together around a progressive agenda. What it means, Tavis, is the $7.25 federal minimum wage is a starvation wage. And I'm proud of the progress we're making, where more and more communities around America now support a $15 an hour minimum wage. Mm-hmm. It means, in my view, to invest $1 trillion to create 15 million jobs, rebuilding our roads and bridges and our water systems. More and more people support that. More and more states and localities are talking about the need to make public colleges and universities tuition-free and substantially reduce student debt. More and more people are talking about transforming our energy system away from fossil fuel to energy efficiency and sustainable energy. More and more people are talking about the need for real criminal justice reform so we don't have more people in jail than any other country. So being a progressive means coming up with an agenda that speaks to the needs of the middle class and working families, having the guts to take on Wall Street and the drug companies and the insurance companies mm-hmm. and the fossil fuel industry and bringing people together, getting them involved in the political process.
I got 45 seconds to go. Let me close on this back to your book, Bernie Sanders' Guide to Political Revolution. This is a book specifically aimed at young readers. What's your message specifically in this moment to young people?
That they have the future to transform this country, that they have the idealism, they have the energy to help lead this country in a very, very different way. We have a great younger generation. It is the most progressive generation of young people in the history of this country. And what I want them to do is not just talk about bold ideas. I want them to get involved in the nitty-gritty of day-to-day politics, run for school board, run for city council, run for state legislature or the United States Congress. Get involved and transform this country. Have the guts to take on the billionaire class, and we can do wonderful things in America.
The numbers are astonishing. Bernie Sanders pulled more young votes than Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump combined in this last race for the White House. His new book is aimed at that generation. It's called A Guide, Bernie Sanders' Guide to Political Revolution, available at fine booksellers everywhere. Senator Sanders, always an honor to have you on. Thanks for your insight, sir.
Thank you very much, Tavis. Take care.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Award-winning writer Salman Rushdie is the author of several books, including Midnight's Children and, of course, The Satanic Verses. His latest book is called The Golden House, set during the time period between President Obama's election and the current political moment. He tells the story of an Indian businessman who moves to New York to start a new life. Salman Rushdie, good to have you back on this program.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Glad to have you. I'm hearing, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm hearing that you're starting to get a little bit annoyed by the comparisons that people are making to a particular character who has green hair in your book to another guy whose hair is sort of orange. You wrote the book, but so why are you getting annoyed by these comparisons?
No, that's on purpose.
Okay.
You know, I mean, that's a deliberate satirical idea.
Yeah.
There's one of the characters in the book says that what's happening in America is that DC, like comics, is taking over DC, like Washington. You know? So there's the character of the Joker who has very, very white skin and really likes that, and green hair, and he's running for president. So, I mean, that stuff, I'm not disguising it. What I'm saying is that it's a minor character. It's in the background of the story. The story is about somebody else, you know, and that's just part of the Yeah. He's like cackling at the edges of the story.
But that doesn't surprise you in this moment that we're in, that anything that is Trump-like is going to get...
It's true. All roads lead to Trump. Right?
Please don't say that. Please don't say that.
You could be talking about anything, though. You could be talking about baseball.
It is certainly...
Suddenly it'll be about Trump.
I think you're right about that. And there's a reason for that. It rates still. Yeah. Since we're talking about... So tell me about the lead character, the story in the book.
Well, you know, in a way, he's not... He has some things in common with the president as well, but he's from another part of the world. The story actually began in India for me, in Bombay, Mumbai, my old hometown, where I had this idea of this, of what really happened over there, which is a kind of strange linkage between, on the one hand, very, very wealthy people and criminal mafias. You know, so for example, the movie industry there is like a lot of mob money in the the movies, you know, which used to be the case in Hollywood. Also a linkage between the criminal mafias and the terrorists who attacked Bombay from Pakistan, you know? And I thought, if I could put somebody in the middle of that, that would be an interesting character. So there's this wealthy Indian businessman who gets involved with the mob, you know, and then his wife is killed in the terrorist attacks on the Taj Hotel. And he and his three sons decide, we're out of here. They decide they're gonna go far away to the other side of the world, change their names, be different people, you know, and that's the story is about them. It's about them coming to America, coming to New York City, to be different people, you know, and they all have their own problems, which work out during the course of the book, and of course the tragedy that they think they've left behind, they haven't left behind. It comes after them. So that's really what the book's about. But the other thing I wanted to do is to set it right now, to set it like the day before yesterday, you know, and to do something which, in a way, you're not supposed to do, which is to write about the exact moment in which you're writing, you know, and the reason you're not supposed to do it is that if you do it wrong, then your book becomes like yesterday's papers, you know, it becomes like disposable. But if you do it right, then you can capture a moment for all time.
That raises two questions, and I shouldn't ask you two at once, but I know you can handle it, so I will.
All right.
The first is, I've seen a lot of chatter from your fans and readers of the book who are trying to figure out actually when you wrote this story, because it does, in fact, so much mirror what we're going through, number one. And number two, since you raised it, how does one write to this specific moment?
Well, I actually had just about finished the book by the time of the election, you know, but then I kind of tweaked it and polished it for the next several months after that. So, but it was written like the 2 years before, really. And the way you do it, I think, is that you stay inside the characters. You know, if you try and make it too much like news reportage, then that vanishes. You know, it's not, because we live in a time where the subject changes so fast, you know. So if you try and tie it too much to that, then your book's going to get outdated before it's published, you know. What you have to do is talk about how human beings are dealing with the situation, you know, how are we living in this world, you know. And if you stay like that inside human nature, inside the characters, then that's a novel. Then that's a thing which has a chance of sticking around.
Let me leave the pages of the book and come into the pages of your real life. When you talk about how you navigate the moment, how are you navigating this present moment? And I ask that against the backdrop of knowing that your first time voting as an American citizen was in this last election.
That went well.
we have you to blame for that? Is that you? So your first time voting was the last time around. And for those of us who follow you, we've noted that you just pretty much stopped tweeting.
Yes, I did.
Right after
on
the election,
on that day. Yes, I did.
So how do you navigate this moment, and why'd you disappear on Twitter?
You know, I don't know whether, I mean, I used to quite enjoy Twitter, and I had fun. But I don't know whether I changed or it changed, but it began to seem to me that I didn't like the tone of voice. I didn't like the noise that was being made on Twitter, that it seemed to become like almost like a lynch mob, you know, ugly, you know, and bad tempered, and people talking with incredible aggressiveness because they're protected by anonymity in a way that they would never talk if they were sitting here.
Absolutely.
You know, and I just thought, I don't like this.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether it got worse or I became less patient with it or some mixture of that.
Yeah.
But I just thought, I don't need this noise in my head. And I just quit, stop.
There are a lot of people, and I'm curious to get your take on this, Sam. There are a lot of people who are, who feel, and I've expressed this view on my own in certain instances, feel that there are certain fellow citizens who feel emboldened by the behavior of the guy in the White House.
Yes.
And so when the president can behave that way,
so
then all bets are off.
Yeah.
And so you're right. You got, we have the anonymity on social media to throw bombs and, you know, throw bombs or rocks or whatever, bottles, and hide our hand.
Yeah, yeah.
But do you think there's anything to the fact that people are emboldened by his bad behavior?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think there's no question that white supremacists in this country have felt enabled by the Trump victory. And we see that. We see that in Charlottesville. We see it everywhere, you know. But I'm just, it's worth pointing out that it's not only in America that this is happening.
Are you sure?
Like, you know, in India, where Narendra Modi, as prime minister, is doing something very similar. He's cranking up a kind of Hindu extremist politics, and minorities, of which the largest is the Muslim minority, are being targeted. There's there's people being lynched. There are people being, you know, journalists being murdered on the doorsteps of their homes, etc. So this is, and this is, again, you can't say that it's directly attributable to the government, but it's people feeling exactly in the same way, emboldened, enabled, feeling that they have the right to behave like this.
I'm listening to you, and I'm thinking about the irony of Muslims catching hell there and catching it here as well.
Yeah, exactly. No, that's for sure happening.
Yeah. I've quoted so many times on this program the great Paul Robeson, because I think he's a great American hero, often overlooked. But I quote him because he was so right when he said that artists are the gatekeepers of truth.
Yes.
Artists are the gatekeepers of truth. I believe that with every core of my being. The flip side of that, though, is in moments like these, and you're eloquent, not just articulate, but eloquent in talking about what this moment means, and yet what you write is fiction. The question I'm asking is whether or not you ever feel like writing fiction in a moment where the nonfiction of our lives is so real.
No, I hear you.
You know where I'm going with this.
No, I hear you.
You ever feel out of place or feel like you're wasting your time doing stuff like the Golden House?
No, what I think, fiction, you know, historically, fiction has been one of the great ways of telling the truth. You know, I mean, if you think about, you know, War and Peace is the most brilliant portrait of Napoleon's Russian campaign, you know, etc. So fiction itself is just another road to the truth. You know, but what I do think has happened, certainly to me, I can't speak for other writers, but to me, is it's made me question and set aside some of the ways I was writing, you know, because I mean, I've been very associated with a kind of fantasy, fabulist, what gets called magic realism, you know. In fact, my previous novel, which was also a novel set in New York, you know, was a novel of that kind. It had like genies and flying carpets and stuff. And then I thought, just what you're saying, I thought, in a world where there's so much untruth out there, there's so much make-believe being propagated, you know, every day, that maybe not fantasy, you know, maybe not hold the flying carpets, you know, and maybe there's a role for artists, or at least I felt a role for an artist like me, to start reestablishing an idea of the truth, to start reestablishing between the writer and the reader, at least, you know, some sense of this is how it really is, you know, and let's start trying to agree on what is really the case. Because we do live in this country in which people can't agree on what is the case. You know, I mean, I found myself lecturing to a quite conservative crowd in Florida a few months ago, in which they didn't believe in climate change. They thought the New York Times was fake news. I said, you know, it's only fake news when they review my books. But that idea that, you know, that there is no such thing as climate change, I mean, et cetera, we just live in these different realities, you know.
And then Irma hit Florida.
And then, exactly. Well, you know, but it's kind of scooping around all Trump's properties.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, proving there is no God. You know. But it's, I think, become very important for America as a country to regain a sense of the difference between truth and lies, you know? And what literature can do at its, if you do it right, is that the reader and the writer can make that agreement. You know, you could read the book, or a book, and you can say, yeah, this is how it is. This is how it is.
This may be an unfair question, and I'm not even sure it fits, but let me ask anyway. What do you hope the takeaway is for readers when they get through the Golden House?
Well, you know, what you want to do is, first of all, tell a good story.
Right.
That's it. You want people to be engaged with the characters and care about them and care about what happens to them. That's the most. But then if you're trying to write this kind of a social novel, which tries to deal with, you know, take a panoramic look at what's going on, because there's all sorts of things in this book, you know, Occupy Wall Street, all kinds of things get in there. Then I think there's two things I hope for from readers. One is for, like, now, contemporary readers, read it, and they have the pleasure of recognition. Mm-hmm. They have the pleasure of saying, yeah, this is how it is. This is how it's been.
Right.
And then hopefully, if I've done it right, then in the future, when people read it, they can say, oh, I see, that's how it was, you know, because you capture the moment. You know, so for readers today, I hope that they'll read it and say, oh, yeah, this is pretty good portrait of how things have been.
And there you have it from the author, Salman Rushdie. The book is called The Golden House, a novel, the latest from Salman Rushdie. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Actress Sonequa Martin-Green is best known for her role as Sasha Williams on the AMC show The Walking Dead. She now stars as First Officer Michael Burnham on the CBS All Access show Star Trek Discovery. Martin-Green is the first black woman to play the lead in the Star Trek Enterprise. Before our conversation, let's listen to a clip from Star Trek Discovery.
Database recognition. Iconography confirmed. Klingon.
I'm Commander Burnham of the United Federation of...
As we say in my neighborhood, that's high cotton. That's high cotton. The Star Trek franchise?
Yeah.
That's a big deal.
It is,
and
right?
A sister.
Yes.
Who's running things.
At that.
That's a big deal.
It really is.
Yeah.
You know, when I was wrapping up on Walking Dead.
Uh-huh. And what a wrap up that was.
Yeah, thank you.
we'll come back to that later.
Yeah. But that was already happening, and then you know, then Star Trek came, and just when I knew that the network and the producing team and the writers were gonna go boldly and have a black woman be at the helm, I was very, very moved by that. So yes. It's a big deal, and I am continuing to process it, to be honest.
I would have loved to have been in the room to hear what their argument, explanation was for why they thought that a sister should lead the Enterprise. I mean, it's a bold move, and I love it.
Right.
I love it.
It is bold.
But like what did they say to you? I mean, did you look at them sideways like,
hey,
you get... You can, what you talking about, Willis? Yeah, did you get? I mean, you,
When I heard that they were that was their plan.
Yeah.
I honestly thought, really, is it your plan? But are you gonna, you know? And then I found out, no. They're very adamant about this. Yeah. This is the vision.
Yeah.
And then I was floored by that, and I feel that. For everyone involved, everyone that was in that decision-making room, I think it was important for them to uphold the legacy of Star Trek by going further.
Yeah.
And I think that's exactly what we're doing with having me at the helm. And I think it also extends beyond me, and it's really important to say as well that we have the first Asian female captain, and then we have the first female captain with a female first officer.
Yeah.
We've never seen that before either.
Mm-hmm.
And then the first openly gay officer as well. And so I feel that they just decided, because these are people who love this franchise, love the canon, love the universe, love what it all represents. And they said, okay, how are we going to step in? How are we going to step into this endowment? And how are we going to make it our own? And how are we going to go further? Because I think that's what, I think that's what every Star Trek should be doing.
Oh, sure,
right?
Sure.
Is going further than the last.
And there's always the risk that when one is that bold, when one is that visionary, and that inclusive, and all the adjectives and adverbs we could put on that, when one is all of that, that means you also run the risk of some pushback.
Right.
So have you got any of that yet? Have you read any of that online?
Yeah,
are you ignoring that stuff?
No, I am. We have gotten that. Mm-hmm. We've definitely gotten the backlash. Mm-hmm. We've gotten the negative response from that. We've gotten people who say that they are true Trek fans who are upset about the diversity. I've heard lots of things. I've heard that it's sort of like checkbox diversity, and so it's empty because of that. I've heard all these things, and you know, I've been saying it a lot lately. It's surprising on one hand because of the universality that has always been Star Trek, and because every iteration has boldly gone.
Mm-hmm.
that surprises me. But on the other end, I am a black woman in America, mm-hmm. and I'm in tune with the times. Mm-hmm. And I was also born in the South and mm-hmm. raised in the South, so it doesn't surprise me in that way. But I will say, though, that I think the people, the sort of naysayers, I think they're small in number, mm-hmm. to be honest, because I have gotten an overwhelmingly positive response mm-hmm. as well. We all have a lot of love, a lot of passion, and a lot of support. And so I think that while they sort of made their voices loud for a little while, they're not the majority.
Yeah, they never are.
Right?
They almost never are.
They never really are.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is important to know and important to say, I think, as well.
Mm. And the thing I've learned, too, and I've seen this happen 1,000 times. So mm-hmm. the naysayers are small but vocal.
Right.
But then something happens when they see the product.
Yeah.
And if the talent is undeniable,
mm.
and if the work is that good, mm. then they get in line like everybody else. Eventually, they have to.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. And particularly in an enterprise that's already as established.
As it right. is. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And already known mm-hmm. for that indivisibility.
Yeah.
I think that, I've been saying that a lot as well, is that I encourage these people who have their issues with it and their inner resistance to it to just give it a shot mm-hmm. and join us and see if it changes you mm-hmm. For the better, because you're right, art, truth, high quality storytelling, it is healing and it is unifying. Mm-hmm. And I think that, yes, hopefully it can't be denied, and so you get lost in it and it's able to shape you, you know, in positive ways. And so I always sort of try to end on that. I always try to say, I get what you're saying, I get where you're coming mm-hmm. from, that's unfortunate. But just join us see what happens.
I wonder if for you there's any intimidation in taking on this role. And I asked that because I was talking to J.J. Abrams, is a friend of
yes.
mine. And I was literally having this conversation with J.J. not too long ago, because mm-hmm. J.J.'s done this at least 3 times now. I mean, mm-hmm. everybody just saw that he's got the next Star Wars reboot again. But J.J. has helmed Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
He's done Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
He's done Mission Impossible.
Right.
So he's done. This guy, I'm like.
JJ.
Yeah, exactly. So 3 times. I said, are you a sadomasochist or what? 3 times he's taken these franchises in his hands. But that's a lot of responsibility when you again, are taking on the role of being the curator and the protector of a franchise.
Right.
So is there any intimidation in this for you?
You know, I.
Do you like intimidation?
No.
Bring it on. Yeah.
I mean, I certainly hope that I respond well under pressure.
Yeah.
But yes, I can. You know what I'd like to say? I'd mm-hmm. like to say, oh, no. I'm just so excited and so blessed. And, you know, I took it and I said, let's go. And I had my moments where I was like, under the weight of it,
mm-hmm.
right? Because it's been coming in waves, and I've been working so hard. You know, I rolled right from Walking Dead.
And they waited for you.
Yeah. Apparently.
The white folk really did want you, because they had to wait till you cleared Walking Dead to start the process.
Oh, man.
So
and I didn't even
know. That's a lot of love.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. I appreciate them. Yeah. I really do. And I just. Like I said, it's coming in waves, and you know, I already knew how important it was. Mm-hmm. I knew what an institution it was mm-hmm. in a film and TV history.
Yeah.
But it keeps cascading.
Yeah.
It keeps cascading,
yeah.
and I see it. I see it in front of me. I hear about it.
Yeah.
I read about it. Just how important it is to so many people, and how important it's been for such a long time.
Yeah. As a daughter of the South, I think I can use this word with you.
Yeah.
How blessed do you feel?
You can.
Okay. How I'll say it again then. How blessed do you feel to like have been connected to these two major? I mean, Walking Dead.
It's a Goliath.
It is. So you go from Walking Dead to Star Trek. I mean, there's like this glow, this halo. Something's following you around.
Hallelujah.
Yeah.
Oh, praise the Lord.
Yeah.
I feel like I am in the middle of his divine plan.
Yeah.
I really do. And I I didn't know what Walking Dead was going to be. I didn't know I was going to be on that show for as long as I was. I didn't know I was going to love those people as much as I do. Mm-hmm. I didn't know. And then that was unfolding. And then to go from that, right as that door was closing, Star Trek door mm-hmm. opened, and I didn't know that would happen. And then to go from that franchise to a franchise even bigger, that is even more beloved, if I can say, mm-hmm. with another group of people that are amazing. Mm-hmm. And stellar and passionate and kind and all of these things.
Yeah.
It's, I can't really, some things can't quite be vocalized.
As we say, favor ain't fair.
Okay.
Favor ain't fair. So just take it.
Oh, man. I'll
so
take it.
Before I let you go, let me circle back to Walking Dead because I intimated that was quite a, that's how you close the show.
Yes.
That is how you close the show. Tell me about the experience and about the close. And
oh, my goodness. Yeah. Well, I knew that, you know, that it was coming, and I knew that it would be in a sort of sacrificial mm-hmm. way. That was all that our amazing showrunner, Scott Gimple, told me. We were in a lot of talks leading up to it. But when I read that script for the first time, that finale script, mm-hmm. I cried tears of joy. Mm-hmm. I really did, because I felt so humbled and grateful to have been given such a poem. Mm-hmm. That's what it was to me. And then, you know, being a walker is not something that you want to do. I never really wanted to be mm-hmm. a walker, but I felt that, you know, being able to be that and have people root for a walker like never before. Mm-hmm. And Kevin Wasner went all out with the makeup as well, and made it him and the rest of the special effects guys made it a really good time.
Yeah.
Even though it was bittersweet and sad, we had fun getting ready for it. And I just, I cannot be more grateful and more full of love from those people and from that experience. I call it my postgraduate degree.
There you go.
Walking Dead, for sure.
I hope this won't sound paternalistic or...
No, please.
But you use the word grateful. We are grateful and proud. Proud that you get to represent us.
Oh.
It's a beautiful thing to see you go from, again, Walking Dead to the Enterprise.
Yeah.
So all the best to you
that
on Star Trek Discovery.
That means a lot coming from you. Because I love you and what you do, so thank you.
I love you for loving me. It's Nico Martin Green, the new face of Star Trek Discovery. You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel Nsi Abuadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.